supervisor who's now in session recording everybody. Supervisor Valenzuela, would you lead us in your pledge, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Maybe have the invocation.
He's here.
Let us pray. Heavenly Father, you place this board of supervisors in positions of leadership over all the residents of Siskiyou County. It's not an easy task they undertake, for they are responsible for the well-being of many people. For this, we ask you to fill our supervisors with wisdom as they discuss the many issues before them this day. Bless them for their service, and may they find their direction and inspiration in you. And we ask this in the name of your Son. Amen.
Amen.
And you maybe have the roll call, please.
Right. Supervisor Valenzuela?
I'm here.
Supervisor Howe?
Present.
Supervisor Harris?
Present.
Supervisor Cobbsett?
Here.
Supervisor Oakley?
Present.
And I do have my little quick blurb here.
Yep.
The board will be convening today as Siskiyou Power Authority, County Service Area 3, and the In-Home Supportive Services Public Authority, and receives no additional compensation.
Thank you. Item 4 is presentations from the public. This time slot is for information from the public. No action or discussion will be conducted on matters presented at this time. You will be allowed 3 minutes for your presentation. Written comments can be presented if so desired by providing a minimum of 7 copies to the clerk. When addressing the board, please state your name for the record prior to providing your comments. Please address the board as a whole through the chair. Comments should be limited to matters within the jurisdiction of the board. I have a few folks to call up this morning. Trish Barbieri, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. I'm here this morning just to do a quick update on the government shutdown and its impact on social services. As you are all aware, on October 1st, the federal government entered into a shutdown. And on October 10th, that began to impact benefit issuance for social services, specifically for SNAP benefits. We received a letter from the USDA indicating that they were putting us on notice that benefits would probably be impacted if the government shutdown didn't end in a timely manner. So in California, that means that by October 22nd, the government shutdown would have had to have ended in order for benefits to not be delayed. That didn't happen. The 22nd, 23rd of each month is a significant date for us in that that's the date that files are sent to the, it's called FIS, it's the electronic vendor for the SNAP program, and they basically load the benefits at that time for the following month. And so we knew that it was going to be delayed. We immediately began collaborating with food pantries and food banks and other partners in the community. And I just want to give a shout out to all of the food banks and the food pantries, and that they were amazing and awesome. Many of them expanded their dates, expanded their food capacity. It was really great working with them, and I truly have a renewed appreciation for the work that they do. I shared with the board that we have about 5,500 cases, which equates to over 9,000 people in the county who are going to be affected by the delay. And so internally, we began working on contingency plans, basically, utilizing funds that we were able to use to fill the gap. Even with that, we had challenges by 2 separate courts and appeals by the USDA. So one minute we were on, the next minute we were off, and we had a pause, and then we'd start. It was just kind of a roller coaster ride. It was pretty intense. The governor saw an opportunity on November the 6th, that was a period of time when the court said, issue full benefits, and immediately before an appeal, right, by the USDA. And so the state began issuing full benefits on November 7th, and that was for everyone who would receive benefits from the 1st through the 7th. Issuance is staggered from the 1st through the 10th. And so anybody post the 7th, so the 8th, 9th, and 10th, they receive their benefits on regular schedule. Happy to report here today that all benefits have been issued, both on an ongoing basis and all of the new applications that were pending during the government shutdown period. So really happy about that. And I'm also happy to report that in the funding bill that the president signed, the president actually funded SNAP through September 30th of 2026. So January 30th, if we don't have a new funding bill going forward, SNAP won't be impacted, but that isn't to say that there wouldn't be other programs that would be impacted. So that's an unknown today. One last thing, just a report of significant concern to us also, is the USDA Agriculture Secretary Brooke Collins has issued notice to states that all SNAP recipients at some point would have to reapply for benefits. We don't know what that looks like. Certainly it's a workload impact to the department. There is suspected widespread fraud in the program, and so that's one way that they think they're going to combat the fraud. As I receive more information, I will share information, but I just want to give you a brief update on the happenings around the government shutdown.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I have a quick question.
Yes. Please.
So I think one of the criteria about, regardless of the fraud, did they want to change some of the criteria for applying, going to work, those kind of things? Do you know that's going to play out?
There are changes coming forward in January of 27 with HR 1. And so these changes that they're talking about today are completely separate from those changes under HR 1. There are other changes that are coming forward due to state budget that are effective January 1st. Myself and Corey Watson, Deputy Director for Employment and Temporary Assistance, will come back next month and do a brief update on those changes and the impacts to our population beginning January.
So quick question with regard to, so in Siskiyou County, cities and in the county, clients that were receiving these benefits, there was no stop in it, right? They all received it. Is that correct?
There was a delay.
There was a delay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Normal issuance is 1st through the 10th, and issuance did not go out until the 7th. So the 1st through the 7th, or 1st through the 6th, really, there was a delay of about a week.
Got it. Thank you.
But everybody has been funded.
Thank you.
It was eligible.
Anyone else? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next up, Elisa Fox, please.
Good morning. My name is Elisa Fox. I live in Wairika, and I'm an IHSS worker here in Siskiyou County. I'm here today to recognize the family caregivers across Siskiyou County by proclaiming November as Family Caregiver Month. Whereas in home support services, IHSS providers are the backbone of long-term care in Siskiyou County, enabling seniors and people with disabilities to live with dignity, independence, and safety in their homes, surrounded by their families and their communities. Whereas within Siskiyou County, 480 dedicated IHSS providers deliver compassion, professional care to low-income residents, saving taxpayers millions of dollars each year by preventing costly institutionalization while strengthening the moral and the economic fiber of our communities. And whereas SEIU Local 2015 represents more than 450,000 long-term care workers across 38 counties in California, serving as a leading voice and advocate for how quality care is best delivered, achieved, and protected, rooted in the fundamental belief that caring for others must begin with caring for those who provide that care. And whereas the work of IHSS providers, most of them are women of color and immigrants, demand tremendous skill, patience, and heart, yet has often, too often, be undervalued and underpaid. Recognizing and compensating this workforce fairly is essential to upholding both economical justice and human dignity. And whereas across California, long-term care workers are organizing and leading to lift care standards, secure living wages, and ensure that this profession, so critical to public health and safety, is defined by respect, stability, and opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Renee Place, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Renee Klaus, and I live over by Jones Camp here in Siskiyou County. And I'm going to do a continuance of what Alyssa was talking to you guys about. When we lift caregivers up, we lift up entire families. Whereas the future of care envisioned by caregivers and their union calls for a world where every worker has the right to form a union. Every Californian has access to affordable, high-quality care, and every community can thrive. Regardless of the race, the background, identity, or zip code, and whereas realizing this future of care requires us to right historical wrongs, to dismantle the inequities and the systemic racism that have long devalued caregiving work, and to create pathways where caregivers can build sustainable careers that allow them to cover basic expenses and plan for the future and live with the same dignity that they bring every day to their patients. Whereas IHSS providers not only meet essential daily needs, but also bring compassion, stability, and humanity into the homes of our most vulnerable residents, fostering connections and care that strengthen the entire county. Therefore, let it be resolved that the community members of Siskiyou County proudly recognize and honors the extraordinary contribution of IHSS providers and long-term care workers, and that you guys stand in solidarity with the seniors and the people with disabilities and the families who depend on their care by officially proclaiming November as Family Caregiver Month. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that ends our public comment, unless we have any online.
Showing none online.
Thank you. Moving on to consent agenda. Are there any items to pull? We'll pull C.
C like cat.
C like cat, thank you.
G and I.
G, I, and I would like to pull item N as in Nancy.
G and I was the other one?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Move to approve the balance of the consent agenda. Mm-hmm.
Second.
Call for vote. Okay.
All righty. So, Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Howell?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobstaff?
Aye.
And Supervisor Ogren?
Aye. And we'll start with item C.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to call for a voice vote on this. I'm not going to support this appointment today.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
So I'm not going to support this appointment today. I'm just calling for a voice vote on this.
Oh, okay. Hold for a vote then, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Alrighty. So 5C, real quick, is the clerk's office was informed that Marie Ingram was stepping back from PSA 2 Area Agency on Aging Executive Board, and that Joan Smith Freeman was interested in serving on the same board, and any action would be taken would also, if they want to be approving Joan Smith Freeman's appointment to the executive board, and then removal of Marie Ingram also as bank signer for the same. So, let's see. If there are no other questions, I'll call for a vote. Okay. Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yes.
Supervisor Haupt?
No.
Supervisor Harris?
After the Klamath mitigation issue, I cannot vote for this appointment.
Okay. Supervisor Cobstaff?
No.
And Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
I will get that information back to PSA 2 because I don't think we are technically the appointing. I think, yeah. Alrighty, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to G.
G, good morning.
Good morning.
So same time last year, we bumped this by 150,000, and this is a year later, and we're bumping it by another 150,000. Trying to figure it out.
Good morning. Board, Sarah Collard, Health and Human Services. So it's an annual contract, and so we're not, you know, it's $150 a year for the services they provide. So it's not, it's $150 a year. So we're bumping it just because this is, you know, the last year of the contract.
But last year, okay, so I think I'm following.
It's an addendum, so it increases the amount of the three-year contract to $450,000.
So the three-year contract originally was for $150,000?
Yes, I'd have to go back, but we've been funding them at that level, yeah. And so this is the last year of MHSA.
Gotcha.
So it's an addendum to the original contract.
Okay, so.
This is all going away in June, so next year we won't be funding those programs just because of the changes under MHSA.
Gotcha. All right, so in other words, it's
same
just...
Same services, same program, same amount.
Okay, it's yearly. Okay,
yes.
Got it. I'll let somebody else take it up.
Move to approve.
Thank you.
Second.
Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Haupt?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobstead?
No.
And Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And item I.
So help me out here, just trying to understand. It looks like this is all going towards renovation. Is that correct?
Ryan, Housing Coordinator, Health and Human Services. This is an operating subsidy for Riverview Guest Home.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
This is an operating subsidy for Riverview Guest Home.
So what's our role? Do we own this property?
No, we do not own this property.
But are we responsible for the renovations that are in this contract?
Last year, the board approved a grant to provide operating subsidies and capital for rehab for licensed residential and elderly care facilities that serve low-income individuals and that are at risk of closing. So that's the intention of this grant. We did an application process where Riverview Guest Home applied, and this is the contract to provide operating subsidies and the rehab funding for the facility to encourage their long-term sustainability to serve elderly, low-income residents of Siskiyou County. And in addition to the contract and the operating agreement, there's a declaration of restrictions that would restrict the property to the uses and intentions of this funding. They would have to continue serving the low-income population to continue receiving this funding. They had to provide financial backup documentation for the county's analysis to determine the appropriateness. And they were the only facility that applied for the program. We had two facilities in the past couple years that closed in Siskiyou County. So this is an issue in Siskiyou County and across California that these facilities are closing. The program is not intended to assist facilities that are serving higher income populations because the expectation is they can charge rates that would be sufficient to cover the upkeep of the facility. But Siskiyou County has a significantly aging population, and it's projected to continue aging. And this is intended to preserve facilities that provide that assisted living that's needed for elderly populations.
The board of cares are a very important piece of our continuum of care because there is, as Madeline said, support provided there for our clients. in terms of, you know, helping them to manage their medications, helping them to get to appointments. They are very low cost in comparison to other types of facilities where we would need to place people if this level of care wasn't available. And Barker's recently closed and Grenada Gardens recently closed. So as Madeline said, it is an issue across the state, and this grant was an effort to support that level of providers. Many of the residents who reside there, you know, pay their Social Security in order to secure, you know, their living situation. We Behavioral Health at times pays a patch to support, you know, to support people who need more support in those settings. But it has been a very important and cost-saving, you know, level of care for us. And so Barker's was a tremendous loss. We've had to place people out of the county because there aren't facilities here. So this, the goal of this grant was to support those providers. And
how many clients, roughly, or how many are housed there?
There's 10 beds.
10
beds,
10 beds. And so does the, I don't know what to call them, the owner of the, I guess, the property, do they charge for residents to be there?
Yes.
Yes, they have to keep it affordable for individuals, elderly individuals that are on SSI, so they're not able to charge significant rates compared to facilities that mm-hmm. focus on higher income populations. In exchange for this funding, they have to do long-term planning with the county. And we've already started that process, even to determine their eligibility for this funding. So we've been developing budgets with the facility and encouraging them to start setting aside reserves for when this program ends, so they'll have the funding to do future rehab on the project. The building, I believe, is... it's a Victorian. It's 100 or so years old, mm-hmm. so it's always going to have, you know, some maintenance. But this will go a long way to getting it outfitted for.
And so, how long is long term? Is the expectation for the owner to provide this?
The planning is for ongoing sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we have most control while we're providing the funds. The declaration of restrictions means that they have to continue in as a facility for this purpose in this exact same situation to continue receiving the operating subsidy. When we provide the rehab, which in order to maintain more control, the county, our department is proposing that we will manage the rehab of the facility directly as opposed to just having the business owner do it. The business owner is, it's basically, to call it a mom and pop facility might be exaggerating its capacity. Sandy is herself an elderly woman who's run it for many years. She's trying to teach her daughter. And the way that the facility hasn't closed yet is essentially by lots of free labor from family members, which we don't consider that to be a sufficient sole long-term plan for maintaining the facility.
So where I'm going with this is, with the renovation money that's coming in, and I hear long-term planning, or they're supposed to be operational, but what, a year from now, if it closes down and it is sold, how would it work with the renovation effort that your department put forward?
My apologies. I know I have long-winded responses. I'll try to get to
that's
it
fine.
Faster. So when we do that rehab of the facility, at that time, I've been discussing options with council, and we think it would be appropriate. You know, the restriction replaces the current declaration of restrictions for the operating subsidies. So to continue receiving it, they have to continue. So they could stop. But when we do the rehab, we have the option of doing a deed of trust. And that would put a hold on the property for that purpose for some number of years, which would transfer even if it was sold.
Thank
and
you.
So that's an option that we've been discussing
okay.
with council
Thank you.
To that's secure helps. Our investment.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Is this the house on North Main Street?
Yes, I believe it is on North Main Street.
Okay, so that place has been around my entire life. I remember as a kid running around those streets of Wairika. And I can say, I mean, the people that lived there and, you know, would walk to the store and stuff were incapable of caring really for themselves. I mean, living solely wouldn't have been an option for a lot of those folks. So, I mean, they, obviously, I'm almost 40 now, so they've been operational for a long time. I do think that they've been beneficial in that. Like I said, I mean, I saw a lot of those folks, and they wouldn't have done well outside of some sort of care. So, yeah, if that's the location and the business, I'll definitely support that.
Move to approve. Thank you.
Sorry.
Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Help?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
Supervisor Kopseth?
Aye.
Supervisor Oker?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. And moving on to item Anna's and Nancy. Good morning, folks.
Good morning. Sheriff Jeremiah LaRue.
Courtney Greenlee, Administrative Services Manager.
Thanks for helping us out with this.
Your best.
I think you know my questions. This, you know, I've asked about this before. We've dealt with these contracts that have become expired, and now we're still dealing with this one. It expired, and we're still talking about this. You're running a contract that's the terms that are through June 30th of 2025. Clearly, we are now heading toward the end of November, and now I'm approving a contract. We are looking at approving a contract that's 5 months expired. I know we're trying to get these services paid for, but I'm still trying to figure out how come we're negotiating contracts and approving contracts that are expired, old, paying for services that are already rendered, and how are we fixing this moving forward? We're already halfway through a new year, and we don't have a current contract that you're working under. And I'm really concerned we're not moving forward quickly enough to solve this problem moving forward. And we really need to figure this out. We can't keep doing this. How are we going to fix this?
So at a former meeting, when other city contracts were under review for the board, we had talked about how the sheriff and I were working with the cities on a different model for the city contracts and how we drafted projected costs or services provided. Once the sheriff and I had agreed upon a template, we had provided that to the auditor's office to gain their approval on the cost model, and the former assistant auditor did not care for it, so we reverted back to the former contract in order to get something expedited that the cities would agree upon. That route was routed to the county in April and sent to the cities for signatures in May, and it took until October 20th for us to hear back from the city of Aetna with signatures on their contract.
Can I interrupt?
Yes.
How come it took so long?
We reached out on May 23rd, June 24th, July 25th, August 5th, August 29th, September 2nd, and October 14th. I can say that Chief Short was extremely helpful in getting the document back to us from the city, but we reached out every 2 to 4 weeks in anticipation of a signed contract. The cities also go through their own approval process of going through their city councils and taking to city meetings, and so we are also dependent on that schedule.
I do believe that there was some discontent in that city council and they lost a member.
Ideally right now, so since that meeting, we have been working with the auditor's office on the request of the board to mimic the former cost model of the city contract template. And I have yet to receive back a completed indirect cost rate proposal. That was originally sent out after the meeting discussion on July 8th. I have followed up with department heads after working with the senior accounting auditor that has since left county employment. Our goal is to have a multi-year agreement in order for us to charge actuals as the board requests, in order for us to obtain a multi-year contract, we will most likely probably have an assumed indirect cost rate proposal within the language and then charge actuals once calculated. But that is also information I am waiting on. So without the information that the sheriff may need, we are unable to draft that contract yet.
So these are very complicated. And I say that a little bit lightly because this indirect rate that we're trying to come to, we've been trying to do this for years. I remember back 10, 15 years ago, and it was figuring out what does, for example, a deputy cost per hour in a contract city when you think about all the things that's going on with dispatching, using of the vehicle, fuel, services, and all that stuff. And we had something established, wasn't perfect, we used that, and then we got away from it. And I know like Supervisor Cobson has brought this up about, I think everybody probably has, about ensuring that the cities are paying for the services. But also being mindful of the whole concept of public safety and trying to balance that. Cities don't have money, we understand that. Nobody has money. So we're trying to work through that. And I think this process with the auditor, I think it's fairly taxing because it's coming up with this figure that I don't think it's easy. And as far as the cities and what they're doing, it's not helpful to us. I guess you could consider the option of we're not going to provide services, but with these types of things, it puts us in a really bad place because it's public safety. And so if we were to cut that off, you'd have potential risk to the people, and that's not fair that city government or county government and their failure hurts the public. And so that's a hard place for me in my mind. With this contract in particular, it's dispatching and record keeping, which we already have a 24-hour service for that with dispatching. So they're just additional deputy or officers that use our services. So they're already, in a sense, paid for, but it's, in a sense, they're paying their share of the usage of our equipment. So I don't feel that there should be any sort of negative repercussions for the community. Not indicating you do, but it's just a hard place. And when they don't get these done timely, we've had this with most of our cities, even though we start them 6 months or earlier. So I guess, what's the collective thought on how to keep our local governments accountable to help us, other than asking, right? I mean, that's difficult.
Clifford.
The mayor, right?
Yeah. Don't sit down. Come on up. I love to hear from you.
That's not fair. Right?
He doesn't know
about
what.
Oh, it is fair.
Run, Clifford.
We're just talking about contracts and the sheriff's department and how to get them paid.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Let me help. That's messed up. Okay, so, Mr. Mayor. So we're talking about the Aetna contract that we have for dispatching and record keeping. And we were just talking about there was a delay. It took 5 months, I think, for it to get signed and returned. And so that was what the question was posed by the board is, why does it take so long? And then how do we make it better? That's what that's. And then you walked in.
That's interesting.
So anyways, we were just discussing that.
I don't know. Maybe mail slow? I don't know. I would say that probably, I guess I would have to research that to see what the process is of where it goes when it gets to our city. Does that make sense?
Does.
And then it waits at least a month, probably, because we only have one city council meeting a month. There's questions, then those have to be answered. So I would say it probably takes 2 to 3 months just to get through a contract in a town like ours, city. But, 5 months seems like that's a little excessive. But I would certainly, you want me to call the city clerk and ask her why it took 5 months? I could do that real quick.
I think it has more to do with moving forward. Can we just try to get it better, faster,
clean it up?
Yeah.
I can tell you one thing that we've done. You're going to think this is crazy, but I'm talking about what my regular day job is. But we just went to DocuSign for all of our contracts. And I am not kidding you. It is insane how the difference is. We send out contracts at the fairgrounds, and I have to call five or six times to try to get a contract back if it's a paper contract. But when we started using DocuSign, which we've even sent a couple of those to the county, and they come back quickly. People see it in their email, they sign it with the little click, and it comes back. So, I mean, maybe that's technology that could help us. Just paper contracts are kind of a thing of the past, but that's talking on a whole different level coming from the fairgrounds, too.
We are on DocuSign.
We provide that option to all vendors. Yeah.
Oh, then I would take that on. Thank you. But I don't know. I'd have to call her and ask, but just to see what the process was. I don't remember.
If you could look into that on your end, that would be a lovely thing.
I would do that.
Appreciate it.
And I'll make sure it doesn't happen again. Yeah.
Please.
Looking forward.
Yes, forward.
What kind of complications are we going to face now that the PD is providing services at Fort Jones?
They already are.
I know, but going forward with the contract, are we going to have two city councils involved, or is that not going to be the lead?
No, they'll...
You're good. So the contract's with Aetna Police, so since they are in multiple places, it's really just under them, so it's not for city, because they are paying, I mean, in a strange way, I guess you'd say Fort Jones is paying Aetna, and then Aetna really has the financial responsibility for where their officers are and using services, so it's really just coming from the city, contracts with us and the city.
Hold that thought.
I'm holding.
I hope that works.
Do you have concerns? I should.
Well, there's about 100 years of conflict between the two cities.
Oh, okay.
There's probably smiling back there. I'm just wondering how this is going to work going forward with two entities signing on to some legal document. Just be aware. I'm just voicing my concern, I guess, going forward with complication.
Okay. Appreciate that.
Any other?
So can we get a template somehow for indirect costs so that it's not, I'm hearing it's kind of customized as to what comes before,
shouldn't
it sounds
be,
like the auditor of time. Huh?
It shouldn't be negotiated, it ought to be based on...
Well, that's where I'm getting to. There should be a template for an indirect cost. You plug in whatever employee it is and it spits out. I mean, we should have that capability.
An indirect cost rate proposal is an extraction of the expenses that our budget incurs every year, but usually that is based on general fund only. But we have expenditures that we incur with our department that are then also become expended in the cities. So it's not just a general fund export of that data.
Mm-hmm.
It's also subjective to anything that's reimbursed outside of cities. So we have to take out anything that has other reimbursement mechanisms so that we're not basically...
overcharging.
Or being reimbursed twice.
I get all that, but I guess I'm looking to the CAO that maybe somebody, I don't see Sherry here today, can come up with some type of...
There is a basic template, but it requires modification per department.
Per department, okay. I'm just looking for ease of use for all departments.
Understood.
Nothing. I get where you're at, but I'm just like, there's got to be a more efficient way, especially with our new accounting system that's coming forward. It's that might be something that our vendor can help us with. Thank you. Move to approve.
Thank you.
Who's second? Thank you. All righty. Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Howell?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
Supervisor Kopseth?
Aye.
Supervisor Okern?
Aye. Okay, moving forward to departmental requests. We want to, hang on, give me a second. Start with item F. Proclamation recognizing November 17th through the 21st as clerk of the board week.
Good morning, Chair Ogren, members of the board, Angela Davis, County Administrator. This proclamation before you today is recognizing our clerk's office, who are the most amazing, awesome clerks in the entire universe. And so we just want to recognize and honor them and all of the hard work that they do each and every day. And so I will turn it over to you, Chair, if you would like to read the proclamation.
I will. Let me get there. Ooh. A lot on my plate here. Here it is. I think.
Do you have it?
I don't. Wait a minute. It's 7. Here's 6. Here it is. Maybe. There it is.
Yeah.
It's very small. Okay. Here we go. Proclamation of the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors recognizing November 17th through the 21st as California Clerk of the Board of Supervisors Week. Whereas California counties provide many services that are essential to the lives of Californians, and whereas the position of the Clerk of the Board of Supervisors Board plays an integral role in the function of California county government, and whereas the clerk of the board performs many legally mandated functions that protect and preserve the rights of the citizens to an open and accessible government, and whereas the work performed by clerks of the board is a time-honored and vital part of the local government, and whereas the clerk's duty of record keeping is revered, their work among the earliest recorded on behalf of the public, and the clerks have long pledged to maintain their neutrality and impartiality in the proceedings of the government. And whereas the California Clerk of the Board of Supervisors Association, an affiliate of the California State Association of Counties, is organized to promote the principles of good government to represent the interest of clerks of the board with legislative bodies and other professional organizations to encourage professional growth and education and to support the objectives of all regional groups established within the association. And whereas it is most appropriate that we recognize the accomplishments of clerks of the board across the 58 counties in the state of California. Now there be it proclaimed that the Board of Supervisors of the County of Siskiyou does herewith proclaim the week of November 17th through November 21st, 2025, as California Clerk of the Board of Supervisors Week in recognition of the high level of services bestowed upon the people of Siskiyou County and the people of California by clerks of the board. Passed and adopted by the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors November 18th, 2025, by the following vote. Thank you very, very much. I guess we need to call for a vote.
We need to have a couple comments.
Okay, make some comments.
I do want to tell you how impressed I am with the clerk's office operations for all the years that I've been involved. You know, they're always under tremendous pressure, particularly with trying to get people to step up to be, which my wife has done, work at the election cycle. I'm very confident in their operation. For such a small operation, I stack them up against any of my bigger counterparts in bigger counties. Mm-hmm. They do a great job.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Any others?
I'll add to that, pulling together the special election this year as quickly as the clerk's office did was impressive.
I'll say that one thing that most people don't see is how much time they spend tracking and tracing special service districts, which I have way too many to keep track of in my district. I really appreciate that because it's just a revolving door with them and it's a struggle to keep them afloat. Thank you.
It's a bit of work.
Yeah.
Supervisor Gobson?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for all the times that I have to walk into that clerk's office and ask questions and for all of the paperwork and paper shuffling and signatures and do's and redo's and everything else that you do. We really appreciate it very, very much. So thank you so much.
Well, I definitely have great backup with Laura. She's
you
got
have a
lot
wonderful
of
office.
Institutional knowledge and you know, been here a while. So.
Yep.
For sure. It helps quite a bit.
All right. With that,
we do need a motion.
I'll make the motion.
Second.
All righty. Supervisor Valenzuela.
Absolutely.
Supervisor Help.
Yes.
Supervisor Harris.
Aye.
Supervisor Kopsa.
Aye.
And Supervisor Ogre.
Aye.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Next week's Ag Commissioner week, that's why.
Okay, we'll jump back to item 6A, community development. Good morning, sir.
Hello and good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board, James Phelps, Senior Planner, County of Siskiyou. Today I present for your consideration the determination of public convenience and necessity. The Grenada Shell gas station, also known as BJ's Deli and Mini Mart, has applied to ABC for an updated liquor license. As of now, the gas station can only sell beer and wine. Their updated license would allow them to sell beer, wine, and hard alcohol. At this time, there's only one other gas station in Grenada that is authorized to sell hard alcohol. That's the Liquor Expo Chevron station. As part of the ABC application process, the Board of Supervisors has an opportunity to determine whether a hard liquor license at this location would be in the public interest of the community. This determination has no fiscal impact on the county. It's simply a procedure that ABC needs to complete before it can continue with its application process. We have not received any objections from the community opposing the liquor license. Planning staff has reviewed this request, found it consistent with the zoning district and the general plan. We're recommending that the board approve one of the two resolutions that we've included with the staff report. This will allow ABC to complete the licensing process. That concludes my presentation. I am available for questions. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Comments? Questions?
Just real quick, is this part of their plan to expand into a full truck stop?
It could be, sir. Generally what happens, Supervisor, is when a facility obtains an updated license, they hold their old license so that their Type 20 will be transferred either to a new location, sold within the county, or it could be transferred anywhere in California. The new liquor license would then be the only liquor license in that location.
Okay.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, they already have this license. There's already 8 within the census tract, so they're just upgrading. We're not adding one.
Kind of. They hold a Type 20 license, which
right.
allows for beer and wine.
Right.
They need to acquire a Type 21 license, so it's actually going to be a new license from ABC. Once they acquire the Type 21, then they'll have to dispose of the Type 20 license,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that's either going to be transferred within the county or outside throughout California.
Mr. Phelps, does that Type 20 license get sold or just transferred? Do they gain anything from selling that?
Liquor licenses are hard to come by, so they'll definitely, unless they're going to donate it, I don't see that happening, but they'll definitely benefit from this.
Okay.
They would have had to buy it originally.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's go to the... I would move to for the resolution to approve.
So the associated resolution with approval of the request that it will serve public convenience.
Yes,
correct.
Ma'am,
thank you.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Call for vote, Wendy.
All righty. Supervisor Valenzuela?
Okay.
Supervisor Help?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
Supervisor Kopsa?
Aye.
And Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, sir. Moving on to item B, Community Development Department. Good morning, Mr. Dean.
Good morning, Board of Supervisors. Chair, CEO. Rick Dean, Community Development Director. This item is to update the board on our progress on the initiative that was directed basically countywide to see how we could reduce the impacts on the general fund. And community development, we have three divisions, two of which are directly tied to general fund dollars. So we go through each of them and give an update of where we are in this process. 2024 staff reported to the board, and this is in terms of the percentage of subsidy of each department by the general fund. So the percentage subsidy that was at the time for building was 35% subsidized, planning department was 86% subsidized, environmental health is not subsidized by the general fund, however, we are subsidized by realignment dollars, and at that time was 60%. This year, currently, those numbers have increased fairly significantly. We're building at 59%, planning at 90%, and environmental health at 67%. All to say, not a fun conversation with fees ever, but planning extremely subsidized. Conversation we have had and are continuing to have is we're working on a general plan update, and with that, it's going to reconfigure planning, structure, fees, and everything else. So, in reality, to drill down and assist the general fund with that, we're looking at 200-300% fee increases across the board, basically, to help assist make a difference. And said, we're not going to be going there until the general plan update is completed, as previously discussed. So that will be looking forward. But that will be a big bite to be chewing on when it does arrive. Environmental health, 2017, we came to the board, we had increases in fees of 40%. And at that time, the goal was to try to get to the point where 50% subsidy, 50% fees were basically running into the division. Now we're at 67%. Subsidize, we'd like to try to get that back in, so our draft currently is to increase another 40% 8 years later. I think this is a good way to do business. I think the CPI should have been engaged 8 years ago. We could continue to move this forward much less egregious, much less impact on businesses. So I'd like to consider that conversation again. All to say, environmental health budget is fairly healthy. It is not tied to the general fund. We manage it internally. We've had salary savings and some maneuvers that we made internally to try to bolster that. Approximately half of our budget went to assist with the head fire cleanup. So I'm currently in the works of trying to get reimbursement from the state to at least get back 75% of that. That was almost $1 million. There is room, provided we get those dollars back, to ease up on that percentage. But currently the draft is at 40%. And with that, it would bring that to 55% subsidy, not even hit the 50%. We have to get up to basically a 60% increase to hit that number, which is, it's a lot on small business. Building department. Building department is basically has two branches of fee structures. One is through ordinance, which hasn't been addressed since 1979. Our basic fees that we have just to go out and do an electrical, plumbing, mechanical are very low. They're like $47, $50 range. So looking forward, they will need to be increased. We've probably been tripling those. And we'll be coming forward with an ordinance on that next year. Immediately, though, the other piece of it is there's a basic building permit fee that is specified in building code by ICC. And that fee we're looking to increase in January. There's a multiple factor of two. And it will be in effect January to try to take a bite out of this. But those efforts are really only going to affect the general fund, investing about $100,000. that it will drive the building cost of permits higher significantly.
Like how significantly? Going from what to what?
Yeah, so I'll tell you. So did a scenario of 1,000 square foot house with a garage. Sorry for the delay. So currently, we took in a permit for a single family dwelling, 1,000 square feet with a garage. Total building permit cost would be about $2,450. With this increase, specifically on the fundamental building permit aspect of it, it would increase to $4,032. So that's about 60%.
A little more than that.
It's a doubling of that permit fee within the structure, right? So it's from basically 581 up to 3,163. In terms that we can all understand.
Real quick.
Bring it down to a square footage level.
When was the last time the fees were increased?
The ordinance fees were increased in 1979, last time.
1979.
Yeah, I know. That's always a fallback. Get that.
Okay.
And those are the basic service fees.
I mean, to me, that'd be different if we did it 5 years ago.
No, I get that. Yeah. I get that. But I don't disagree. But for instance, in some of the school districts, and I'll take the average home probably is now around 1,800 to 2,000 square foot that's being built, if not larger.
Yeah.
You're looking at $5,000 to $6,000 just in that permit, and the school fees could be upwards of $10,000 to $15,000 as well before they even touch anything. So, I mean, I get where you're coming from. I just don't know how palatable it's going to be.
Yeah, and frankly, it's not coming from me. It's coming from Gresham.
From what?
Angela Davis County Administration.
No, and I get that, but I think the other part of it is, I think this is where it's driving our costs, is CalPERS is making tremendous mistakes on the retirement side, which we're going to eat, on a percentage for what we have to pay for employees, as well as the health insurance premiums that are killing us, because those are, we have no control over them, but yet we get stuck with them. And that's what drives up the cost, mainly for what we're talking about.
And that's true. And we also, we did have a meeting with regards to this matter, and the comparables are shameful for what we charge versus our other counties.
Yeah, I know.
Bordering us. I know. So, and it does demonstrate why we have this need to increase.
I get it.
So there was an analysis done. There was research done.
I get that.
It's painful.
I get that too, but our salaries are shameful compared to other areas too.
No, not anymore.
I'm not talking about us here.
Oh.
I'm talking about in the general public, the people that are trying to build homes. I mean, I have a community that's not labeled disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. No. You wonder why there's homeless in California?
It's not a fun conversation.
No, it's not.
But just to completely frame this with the school fees and everything else, right? So breaking it down to a square footage aspect. So currently, for this structure, 1,000 square foot house with a garage, it's $2.45 a square foot. Strike that. With this increase, it would bump it up to $4 a square foot. I'll say, and school fees for the same structure right now is $5,170. Whether it matters or not, the building fees are still below the school fees.
I get it. I understand it. It doesn't mean
it's like palatable.
Yeah.
Well, so what do you do to mitigate it? You know, I would certainly think that you would phase it in over a period of time. You would give people plenty of advance warning, I'm thinking the builders, so they can school the people that are, hey, you better do it before this year ends instead of 2 years down the road type of thing. But I don't know how you do not get away from raising costs when, you know, in effect we're subsidizing, which is not...
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
Can we do a percentage increase over the next 3 to 5 years so that we build to it? Like, what kind of what you're saying, like phase it in?
Yeah, I think that would be something that would be presented that we could, that I would support. I mean, I don't want to go from 100% increase to something, particularly someone that's right there thinking about building their dream house of some sort.
Yeah, I give them a little bit of time. Like, yeah, I agree with that.
You know, the other piece to it, you know, this is just me thinking outside the box, but I think if you want to subsidize, you would subsidize entry-level plain Jane housing under, you know, 1,200 square foot house. Someone that's just getting started to, you know, to build housing. I'm not worried about my $1 million person that can build a house up on, because that cost is insignificant. Where can you impact that's going to make a difference if you want to create some building? Because we have a homeless population because housing is so expensive and you can't get anyone to build anyways. I'm open to any and all ideas is what I'm getting down to.
Couple questions.
Yes, sir.
Ancillary structures.
Yeah.
You know why,
yeah.
I'm bringing it up.
I have a class.
I'm just wondering, so is there, when you calculate a fee for ancillary structures versus a home, is there a complexity piece of that, or is it just square footage?
No, it's a complexity piece of it.
Okay.
It's very complicated how to derive fees.
Okay.
You can spend some time for building.
Yeah.
Or
an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This particular building permit fee that's dedicated through the building code is more impactful on, obviously, not the bones.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, from my perspective, the one thing that I would support is making sure we're not adding additional burden, kind of perspective, to the cost of the structure. You know, I don't know where they come up with the figures. In California, they say 40% of the cost of a new structure is regulatory costs. I think a lot of that, you know, the jurisdictions are additional bells and whistles added to the cost of a permit that I will have a watchdog eye on that doesn't happen here. I did have another question from a taxing standpoint, though. I don't know if you can answer this, but you build a home, okay? Yeah. There's a price for the home, and then there's a tax calculation on what the taxes would be on the home. Does that also include the permit fees and everything else that's wrapped into that? Because that seems almost like double taxation to me.
I am going to say no. It's the value of the structure of the property on the line, right? The assessor deals with.
Right, but when you, I know this, when you buy a home, Prop 13 tax is based on the purchase price.
Yeah.
Anyway, just
I have to do
if we can look into that, and if there's any way we can affect that to reduce the tax burden, I think our constituents would.
So am I hearing that they're assessed by the permit fees as well? I don't think so.
Well, that's the total purchase price of the home.
Well, purchase price is different than a permit, though. And I guess where I'm going with this is if on a new house, if there was permit fees of $20,000, hopefully that wouldn't be part of the assessment.
Well, it is when you go get your loan. The total loan value is what becomes your assessed value.
Yeah, I get that part, but I see where you're at, but I'm struggling with.
We need the assessor to come.
Yeah, I was going to say. I wouldn't have thought that we were taxing that part, but okay.
Well, yeah, I've never.
Yeah, seen, I don't know.
I've built homes elsewhere, and yeah. I've never seen that piece articulated out on the total price of the home.
Because it's...
That's what your loan amount is.
Yeah.
It all goes into the cost of building a home.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't have a good answer for you there.
By the time you bring this back, I hope someone does.
Well, assessor address that.
Maybe the chair will insist on it next year.
Yeah.
Hey, now. Is there any accommodation in those fees for developments or low-income housing or workforce housing being built by developers? Is all of that the same, whether it's just because it's a single-family home? Is there anything different for duplexes, multifamily homes, anything like that?
No, it's the same across the board, equal everyone. I would say that our waiver of fees, permitting fees for the Slater Fire have all passed now. Folks with the McKinney Fire are still in order. The Mill Fire are still in building permits that we get associated with those. I haven't passed.
But that's discretionary on our part.
That's based on a four-year term since the declaration date for the emergency.
Okay.
One more question.
Go ahead.
Sorry about that. So over the past several years, due to fire, we waived a lot of fees.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to account for that when you bring us an increase that's needed? Because that seems to skew the recovery numbers that we're dealing with.
It does. It has.
What I'm saying is if we were just building as normal, there would be additional fees coming in that
right.
would be offset.
Yeah.
Which skews the numbers.
I can just say that last year, about $60,000 that were basically donated or not received as revenue from the Slater Fire builds.
We did the same thing in Chestina, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah. Chestina, McKinney, we know, mold outside of our in effect now.
So
there's definitely revenue loss there.
I understand, but I mean, would you give me a percentage to come up to what we should be at? We should
we've already
some way to normalize what we've offset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's not because I'm new normal.
That's not an ongoing.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, quit. I'm running out of towns. Yeah. I'm done.
Okay. Anybody else? All right. Thanks for the good news. What's next?
Scheduled to come into effect in January.
Will you be here?
No.
I think you bring it up in December.
Yeah. Okay, your next item C.
Next item C.
Amnesty pesticide collection.
Yes, so I was directed to bring this back to the board. Once completed, collaboration of folks with the county, Commissioner Jim Smith coordinated with the Department of Pesticide Regulation, who sponsored this event to occur. It was facilitated by Environmental Health, OES, and Ali Kutzer, and also Ag Department take care of this conversation. There were two events that were held. One was August 13th and the other was September 10th. The first event was not supported individually by the communities. So this was backup, an AMSTI event that was countywide to basically bring in illegal pesticides that are being used for the cannabis cultivation. We took in about 50 pounds of pesticides on the first event, but they were all mill runs. The individuals did not participate. They did not come in personally with their vehicles and drop off stuff. They organized one person to go out, gather material, bring it in, so forth.
so that one individual went out to sites, got material, and at the end of the day, we had about 50 pounds of illegal pesticides that were manifested after disposal. We utilized Hancon as our hazardous waste contractor. Basically, we're able to save some money, essentially, by piggybacking on a contract with, that they have with DTSC that we use continually. So, fortunately, we were able to put that together quickly at a lower cost, so that was all good. Because of the lower attendance, basically, on the first one, we elected to have a second one, which took place on September 10th. But in the interim, Santa Vanilla from our department, waste management unit manager, went out and met with the communities, discussed the illegal pesticides, the dangers of them, the exposure consequences, so forth. And we had a second event. Second event, we had more participation. Approximately 100 people came in, 50 vehicles, they did come in person to drop off stuff. But there we collected about 20 pounds of illegal pesticides. So in all, not a lot came in. Total cost for that was $18,558, which will be hopefully reimbursed to Mr. Jim Smith.
50 pounds and 20 pounds.
Yeah, not a whole lot. And I also needed to give a thank you to Fitz and Elijah Yah, who helped with the interpretation through our documents. We had this out in five different languages and so forth. Brunch and I posted things on the highway. So it was well, pretty well represented as far as advertising goes. So, anyway, I wouldn't call it a huge win. One thing, though, that we are seeing now on operations, there's a lot less. Fumigants are occurring. Yeah. Where they all went, no. I'll also throw out after the first day on the 13th, operations with the sheriff they found 50 pounds on the site. Shortly after that.
So you're finding less of the fumigant in itself, or less of the soda cans cut in half with the stuff in with the greenhouses?
Yeah, so they're both. Right, that's a process that they use to fumigate with the pesticides. Yeah, so we're finding very few. Once in a while, we'll pick up a bag here and there. Not seeing the evidence of the fumigation now. It's been reduced to, obviously, 90%. Just an observation to what we have been doing within the Mount Shasta-Vista area. We have not had a lot of operations to the north in the Doris area to get a handle. That's the report on the illegal pesticide amnesty collection days.
Don't do another one.
Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, can we take a break?
I was just going to ask if you needed a break before
that
we continue.
Would be nice.
All right, we'll be back in 10 minutes.